Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. In moments, the economist Rekha Juhas will look at the move from the home to the factory as a site of economic activity in the early 19th century as a precedent for today's pandemic-driven move back to the home. And then Vanessa Williamson will look at the roots of the political discourse around the taxpayer. It originates in Southern elites' successful efforts to disenfranchise Black people and reverse Reconstruction in the 1870s. Before that, a few words on the dawn of the Biden era. I spent much of my life as a commentator on economics and politics, hating Democrats. The party is an integral part of the rightward move in politics of the last 40-some years. By purging the party of its New Deal and civil rights components, Bill Clinton did a lot to consolidate the transformation initiated by Ronald Reagan. And you could even argue that that transformation, the lowering of expectations, the impulse to deregulate, the crackdown on labor, you could argue that all began under Jimmy Carter. Clinton ended welfare and intensified the lurch towards mass incarceration. The Dems are often softer and more duplicitous about those moves than the Republicans, but that's what makes them more effective. But so awful was Trump that I actually voted for Biden in a state where I didn't need to, just to do my bit to rack up the popular vote margin. I have to admit that early signs from Biden are semi-promising. The raft of executive orders on Inauguration Day, on the pandemic, on immigration, on climate, on eviction and foreclosure protection were pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good. His Treasury Secretary-designate Janet Yellen has said good things about the need to go big on a support package to help people cope with the corona crisis. It almost seemed as if some of the activism on the left in recent years had changed the political calculus. But, and with the Dems there is always the but, talk by some Democratic leaders in Congress, including Senate Budget Chair Bernie Sanders, that they would use the reconciliation process, which allows legislation to be adopted by simple majority vote in the Senate rather than a filibuster-proof two-thirds, has been shot down for now by Biden's people. Politico reported on Thursday morning that Biden wants to be bipartisan about it all and not ram legislation through. Things are still in flux, so this isn't the final word, but Biden does seem to be serious about working with a party that devoutly wants him to fail. So, while the early signs, like the executive orders and Yellen's talk, were encouraging, this totally unrequited bipartisan fetish is a reminder that the Democrats really know how to disappoint their main popular constituency. By that I mean regular voters, not their money bags. There's an old saying that Republicans fear their base and Democrats hate theirs. We'll see how that all plays out. It might not be pretty. Okay, now working from home. According to the Census Bureau, as of late December, 37% of adults lived in a household where at least one member was working remotely. Perhaps surprisingly, the numbers didn't vary enormously by race. 33% of Black people and 38% of whites lived with a teleworker. Education, however, is a major factor. 20% of those with a high school diploma versus 62% of those with a bachelor's or higher. Income, too, is a major factor. 15% of those earning under $25,000 versus 74% of those over $200,000, their share rising with each bracket. We should keep this in mind when we hear talk about everyone working from home. Most people aren't. Nurses, doctors, grocery store workers, factory workers, they can't. But enough are that it's worth thinking about whether this will become, as they say, the new normal. My first guest, Rekha Juhas, is one of three authors of a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper, Away From Home and Back, Coordinating Remote Workers in 1800 and 2020. It looks at the move from homework to factory work two centuries ago as a hint for what our future might hold. Juhas is an assistant professor of economics at Columbia. Rekha Juhas. You take an interesting approach to this question going back almost 200 years to the transition from home to the factory. Could you describe that process, what people did and what they came to do?
Yeah, so we started thinking about this question because we had been studying precisely this transition from working from home to working in the factories. And it really struck us as being, you know, as we got more and more into the literature, we were sort of, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but as we got into the literature, we were learning just what a monumental change to people's working lives this meant on the one hand. So when people were working in their homes, they had a lot of independence. They were typically working for a piece rate, which means that they got to set the hours they were working, when they were working. And so when mechanization in some industries started, this triggered a shift to needing to locate production in a plant and sort of bringing workers together. And in its mature form, this then led to the factory system, which from sort of the entrepreneur side also led to a host of new challenges, because basically they were not in any way equipped to run, manage, coordinate the labor in this new environment. And really, because this had been such a monumental sort of historical shift, what sort of research in the mid 20th century uncovered was that entrepreneurs at the time had like no basic knowledge about what we would think of as sort of professional management today, and so they had to sort of figure this out as they went along through a process of trial and error.
Now, of course, the workers too, who had previously been working at home and then gathered to this factory, often under unpleasant conditions, were probably not terribly happy about their fate either. So there was an awful lot of difficulties just managing the people involved.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of sort of thinking about the parallels to today, this is really the aspect where we felt that there was an important lesson to be learned, which was that both from the worker's side and from the firm side, figuring out how to coordinate the labor force was a completely novel challenge. And so as you sort of rightly point out, what the first generation of entrepreneurs sort of did was to implement this crushing factory discipline that you can read about, like in the novels of Charles Dickens, for example, and that's sort of amply documented in the historical literature. And over time, they actually moved away from that. But because they didn't know how to really coordinate labor under this new setting, they were really sort of just experimenting with, first it was factory discipline, really harsh sort of dismissals for minor infractions. Then I think that the cotton textile industry is what we know best. And so in the cotton textile industry, they sort of wanted to bring in family units, thinking that the head of household there could sort of implement some sort of hierarchy. Then that didn't work out. Then they wanted to employ female spinners because they thought that they would be more docile and easier to manage. But it turned out that they didn't have the physical strength to sort of run a lot of the machines. And so it took a good couple of decades before the industry actually settled on paying efficiency wages to the workers to incentivize sort of unobservable effort.
That's how economists say, if you pay them better, they'll work better.
Yeah.
Of course, the great temptation of the factory system was that gathering together all these workers together to work very expensive machinery promised, at least on paper, a great leap in productivity. But it really took a while to realize that productivity gain because of these management challenges, right?
Yes, and that's sort of the other important parallel that we're trying to sort of bring to the current setting, which is that on the one hand, mechanization of the production processes, that did in many cases lead to a huge productivity advantage, say in the case of cotton textiles, which was the flagship industry. But because the organizational innovations hadn't yet been developed to efficiently manage these factories, it turned out that a lot of these factories were operating inefficiently. And so you can think of that as being sort of the costly side of moving to the factory setup. And so it was really only over time as firms and entrepreneurs and workers sort of figured out what the best organizational forms were to run these factories, that the full benefits of the full productivity advantage of factory work materialized.
So it really wasn't until the turn of the 19th century into the 20th that professional management really developed. This is the territory of Alfred Chandler and such. It took the better part of a century for this all to be worked out.
Yeah, I mean, this was something, you know, we really got into this literature last summer when we were developing this research. And in the British context, it was Sidney Pollard in the mid 20th century who did sort of path breaking research showing that that anything that we would think of as professional management. And here you should think of things like just basic accounting practices of knowing sort of which line is profitable and which one isn't. These were things that were missing in even the most successful firms of the day. And it really took them a long time to figure these things out.
Now, I'm reminded of that old Robert Solow quip about how decades ago he used to say that you can see the computer age everywhere, but in the productivity statistics. The 90s productivity took off for a few years, and the line was that they'd finally figured it out. They'd finally figured out how to manage these new technical innovations. That evaporated, but there was something similar going on there, that it took a while for this new technology to have any economic payoff.
Right, that's exactly right. So in a different paper, that is exactly what we show for the cotton textile industry in France, where we have plant level data and we're able to observe the productivity of plants. We show that at a very early stage of technology adoption, there's just this huge number of firms that are operating the technology very inefficiently. And over time, these firms basically disappear from the market, and they're replaced by firms who are much more efficient at operating the technology. And we tie that exactly to these organizational innovations that were made through the 19th century. And you anticipate it very well, because the Bob Solow quote is exactly what we motivate our paper with, in terms of trying to understand why a lot of these new technologies are so hard to contemporaneously document in the aggregate productivity statistics. And one of the explanations that's being given for the IT revolution and the lack of sort of productivity that was observed in the 70s and the 80s is precisely that firms needed to invest a lot in intangible capital and reorganize the firms to make efficient use of the new information technology.
Okay, now let's get to the present. There's a lot of enthusiasm about working from home, increasing productivity, although it seems to be more about cutting costs, and those aren't exactly the same things. Managers think we won't have to pay rent, we won't have to offer perks, we won't have to offer cafeterias, we can cut pay if people are living in cheaper areas. They're just seeing dollar signs from this cost cutting around work from home. Is that feasible? Your approach is to take a look at a number of industries and just measure how much interpersonal contact is important in them. Just tell us what your approach was to try to suss out whether that's going to be possible in the present, or how easy it's going to be in the present.
We took the lessons that we think one can learn from the transition to factory-based production, and the idea being exactly what we were just discussing before, which is that there's a productivity advantage potentially to moving to the new working arrangement, but it also comes at a cost if the organizational practices aren't efficient to make use of that new technology. So put sort of in plain English, you can move many workers into working from home. People have laptops, people have computers, people have the communication technology that makes this technologically feasible. But when you think of sort of what a lot of workers are doing in their day-to-day working lives, they're also communicating and coordinating to a great deal with their co-workers. And the extent to which you can do that efficiently at home is potentially not the same as the extent to which you can do that when you're seeing your coworkers 9 to 5 every day or even longer. What we did was we basically compared data from February before pandemic-related lockdowns had been rolled out to data from May, when at least in the U.S. there was sort of a very temporary consensus towards almost full-blown lockdowns across most of the country. And we looked at sort of who was working from home at these two points in time. And what you can see is that in February, which you can think of as sort of being the normal times, it's indeed true that industries in which there's sort of greater technological feasibility to have people working from home because they work with a computer, for example, you do see a higher propensity to work from home. However, you also see sort of a role for the need to coordinate amongst employees. So industries that are characterized by a large need to coordinate across co-workers see less working from home in normal times. Now, when you look at the data in May, what you see is that the effect of technological feasibility becomes extremely important. So basically, the extent to which technological feasibility predicts working from home is going to be massive, but the relationship between the need for coordination and working from home completely breaks down. So there's basically no relationship that you can discern. And what you can sort of learn from that, or the way that we interpret these associations, is that in the pandemic, basically, firms and workers are doing what is possible. They're not necessarily doing what is optimal. So put differently, any job that you can do from home is being done from home, irrespective of what sort of cost this entails, simply because going to the office is not possible because of the public health hazard. What this then also implies is that in the future, once sort of the public health hazard subsides, it's not necessarily clear that for all of these occupations and in all of these industries, firms are going to find it beneficial to have their employees keep on working from home because this need to coordinate amongst workers is so important.
I'm speaking with the economist Rika Juhas.
There are also issues of like monitoring and discipline too. Like how can the boss keep the employee from goofing off if he can't watch him?
Absolutely. So there is sort of a literature in management that has looked at virtual teams, which you can think of as having some lessons to bear on the questions of working from home, because these are team members who are not located in the same physical space, and they often see problems not just with being able to coordinate, but also with problems of monitoring and incentivizing workers. So that is I think also, that's not necessarily something that we've looked at in the paper, but that is also something that I think is on a lot of employers' minds.
Well, then if you like think about why cities grew to such prominence, there are great economic advantages to gathering people together in large numbers. The exchange of ideas, for example, is very important. Agglomeration effects, or as I say in the literature, or industrial districts. People who work in similar industries tend to often gather in the same neighborhoods so they can have an exchange of information. Is there any way to make that virtual, or is that something that really requires face-to-face contact?
That's a fascinating question. It's something that has again come to the forefront of the debate as we think about sort of whether the New Yorks and the San Franciscos of the world are going to look different 5 years down the line or not. When you look at what happened in the 90s, a lot of observers were already predicting that distance and the location of people would not matter as much as it has in the past because of these new information communication technologies that have been introduced. And if you look at the data, it really doesn't show any effect in terms of a declining importance of distance. And if you look at the pre-pandemic world in 2019, finance is still massively located in New York. It's not sort of evenly spread across the five boroughs. It's very much concentrated in Manhattan. It's not just concentrated sort of uniformly across Manhattan. It's concentrated very much in lower Manhattan. And now we have the type of data to look at what's going on block by block. And you really see that financial firms cluster in single buildings or at particular floors within high-rise buildings. And so this idea that there's an advantage to physical proximity is very much there in the literature. And one of the ways to make sense of that is this notion that people who are in close proximity to each other, people who go to the same cafeteria or who share an elevator, they will talk to each other, and these random meetings generate these types of knowledge and idea flows that are so important for many of the 21st century industries. So whether technology can substitute for that is, of course, you can say that the technologies of the 21st century are a lot better than the technologies of the 1990s. I'm not in the business of making predictions, but I am skeptical that we have technologies that can fully substitute for these types of interactions. They can serve as good complements for them, but I'm not sure they fully substitute.
Yeah, a Financial Times columnist said a few months ago, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, I think it's Polita Clark, said a few months ago that we're just kind of running off the capital, that was the social capital that was gathered in the period of working in the office. And that's going to erode over time as these relationships deteriorate and become more distant. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I think firms and organizations who have allowed for flexible working or who have employees who work from home sort of pre-pandemic, one practice that seems to facilitate sort of productive working from home is having team members have face-to-face interactions some of the time. So that might be, you know, coming into the office some days of the week, or that might be other sort of interactions. But I think the consensus, in my understanding, is that we don't have any good evidence that the technologies that are available today are able to fully substitute for face-to-face interactions. And what I think might evolve, at least in the short term, is some sort of hybrid arrangement where people are working from home some of the time potentially, but not necessarily all of the time, and particularly not in industries that are heavily reliant on this type of coordination, and industries that are heavily reliant on sort of idea generation and innovation.
Yeah, and then it's also taking a toll on the workers. A report that there's just no boundary anymore between work and home, and they miss it. The Wall Street Journal had a funny story the other day about workers who are doing fake commutes just to have some kind of ritual division of home and work. They find they miss the space out time they get in the subway or, you know, whatever, listening to audiobooks in the car. That boundary between work and home seems to be important to keeping people's sanity, and we're testing whether we can maintain sanity under these conditions.
Yeah, I mean that's also a super interesting question. When we got into this line of research, one of the things that struck us is that I think both in the UK and in the US, there was a push from sort of policymakers in thinking about work from home pre-pandemic as a way to sort of facilitate employees' work-life balance, particularly in households where you have two people working full-time and taking care of dependents. There was a push that sort of working from home might lead to more work-life balance because you can cut down on commuting times, because you have more flexibility over your hours. But when I think people looked at survey data, exactly as you say, the results weren't clear cut. So some people seem to benefit from it, but there's also the encroachment on home life and the setting boundaries. A friend of mine once described this as not working from home, but living at the office. And that, I think that does chime well with a lot of people's experience in the pandemic, which is of course different for a variety of reasons. But you're right that it's not clear cut that work from home every day actually is a valuable sort of non-monetary benefit for employees. I think there's a lot of heterogeneity, and again potentially maybe some form of hybrid working from home some of the time might be where we're headed.
And finally, your conclusions are a little tentative. You say we're just not there yet. Is that just caution, or do you think it's really going to take a lot of time, but we may get there?
They're tentative because this is an evolving landscape, just as it was the case in the Industrial Revolution. Both the technologies that make the new working arrangement productive in terms of mechanization in the Industrial Revolution or information communication technologies that make it increasingly productive to work at home, these keep evolving, making the benefit side sort of increasingly high. And of course, organizations are going to adapt with all sorts of innovations in terms of trying to make these barriers and costs of working from home less burdensome. So I think, you know, this is not a static question. Both the cost and the benefit side of working from home are going to be evolving, and the pandemic is giving sort of both workers and firms sort of a huge push towards innovating, both in making the technology better and reducing the cost in terms of organizational innovations. But you know, partly because I'm interested in sort of all things spatial in economics as a researcher. I really do sort of at a fundamental level believe that that face-to-face interactions are extremely hard to substitute, and I don't see technology being able to easily replace that in the near future to a complete extent.
That was Rekha Juhas, assistant professor of economics at Columbia and co-author of Away From Home and Back, Coordinating Remote Workers in 1800 and 2020. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the third movement of Alfred Schnittke's String Quartet No. 3, performed by the Thalle Quartet. After all that patriotic folderol and invocations of bipartisan comity at the inauguration, I felt the need for some Soviet modernism to clear the air. Next, the political roots of the concept of taxpayer. We often hear conservatives in particular use the word as a collective identity rather than citizen or worker. My next guest, Vanessa Williamson, has an article in the winter issue of Dissent magazine, which you can find on their website, on the concept's roots in Southern elites' efforts to undo Reconstruction and disenfranchise the freed slaves and their descendants. Current usage, it turns out, carries with it a lot of that heritage. Vanessa Williamson is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. I've always been suspicious of the word taxpayer for us political associations, but it really comes with a really unsavory history, right? You know, we knew that Reagan and Republicans love to talk about taxpayers, but it really goes way back into the 19th century, right?
That's exactly right. The sort of origins of taxpayer rhetoric and taxpayer politics stems from the reaction to Reconstruction, that is to say, the brief period of time in the American South when there was multiracial democracy, or an experiment with multiracial democracy, an effort to create multiracial democracy. And the white supremacists who had led the Confederacy successfully overthrew those governments through voter fraud, through election violence. And one of the ways that they sort of created a veneer, I guess you'd say, for the paramilitary violence that accompanied their overthrow of Reconstruction was by discussing themselves as taxpayers and sort of adopting the kind of mantle of respectability and legitimacy that taxpayers have.
Now, what did governance look like in that roughly decade or so period of Reconstruction before it was overturned?
Once the radical Republican Congress, of course, back then the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, and the party of Black freedom, when the Republican Congress at a federal level ensured Black voting rights, Black male voting rights, universal suffrage for men, they put federal troops in the South to ensure that that would actually occur. And under universal male suffrage, you see Black people vote across the South. You see them get elected to office. So you'll often hear, you know, in our own lifetimes that so-and-so was the first Black legislator since Reconstruction, right? Because there was this period in the late 1860s and early 1870s when Black people held political office. In South Carolina, which is a state that I look at closely in my article, the situation was particularly sort of revolutionary because a majority of the population of South Carolina was Black. And under universal male suffrage, that meant a majority of the legislature was Black too. So it was an extraordinary, just a revolutionary change, a social revolution to an extraordinary extent. And for the first time in American history, there was a commitment. It was tenuous, as we certainly found out, but a commitment to the idea that you could have a democracy that had a principle of political equality for both Black and white.
What kind of policies were they pursuing during this brief period?
Oh, well, they were not given an easy time of it. So obviously the southern states were in a state of collapse on a couple of different dimensions. Obviously, there was immense destruction to the infrastructure of the South because of the war. And at the same time, in South Carolina, you could say that the population, politically speaking, had doubled. That is to say, half the population had been enslaved, and now they were free people. The level of poverty that we're talking about is really quite extraordinary. And suddenly the population of South Carolina has doubled. There's half the population. It was illegal for them to become literate, right? So we're talking about a public education challenge on an extraordinary order, and not just because there were the freedmen who needed public education, but the South had never really had a public education, even for poor whites. So the Reconstruction governments were tasked with rebuilding a country that had seen quite an extraordinary level of damage in the war. They were tasked with building a public school system for the first time. And they were tasked with doing that without any of the aid you might imagine would occur, in later the 20th century, let's say, a Marshall Plan or something along those lines that would give these states that were destroyed the chance to rebuild.
Now, as I recall, even in the decades before the Civil War, the South strongly resisted anything like a serious public revenue system, any kind of public sector, as we would think of it today, right? They had nothing to build on, even though much was destroyed during the war.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's the public schooling system, but it's also roads and canals and all sorts of infrastructure programs. Under a government run by slaveholders, there was almost literally no commitment to the public in any sense, because in large part, slaveholders recognized that democratic government, even one limited just to white men, a democratic government with any capacity was a danger to slavery. Because, and this was something that was a constant fear before the war, if most white men don't own slaves, then it is in their interest to put a heavy tax on slavery, right? It is in their interest to invest, even if they don't have any commitment to, racial equality or even basic humanity that might make you want to end slavery. For poor white farmers, they knew full well that slavery was terrible for their economy. Right? Because they're competing with people who were literally forced to work for free. So you see across the South that some people are becoming extremely rich. But if you're not a wealthy slaveholder, there's basically no economy for you. You'll be living kind of at the margins. So the result is that the South is just enormously underdeveloped before the war. And then what infrastructure they had, of course, in terms of railroads and things of that sort, was largely destroyed.
And one of the great planters' fears was any kind of alliance between poor whites and poor Black people, right?
That's exactly right. In the very, very early days of slavery in the United States, we're talking in Virginia, we've all heard now of the 1619 Project. Well, looking back almost that far, there was a period of time before the racial quality of slavery had actually become settled in law. That is to say that there were enslaved Black people and there were indentured white people. So they were serving as indentured servants for a period of years. The death rates were so high in Virginia at that time that very few people survived indentured servitude. What you see is as more indentured servants are living long enough to become free, serious concern among the ruling elite that these poor whites would recognize what we would call today a class interest with enslaved Black people. So you see the imposition of sort of a structural racism, that is to say the imposition of, for instance, laws against intermarriage between the races, right? And you don't pass laws for things that don't happen, but suddenly it became terribly important that Black people and white people could not marry. You see a whole series of other laws intended to give poor whites basically some marginal privileges and to split the poor white class from the enslaved Black population. And, that worked. And we, in some sense, we're still living with it.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's so many things in your piece that say we're still living with these things today. You say in just a sentence or two, and don't develop the point, so I'm curious to see what was behind it, that there was no serious land reform. What happened?
From a modern perspective, if you look back, wouldn't it have made sense that people whose labor had been stolen from them their entire lives and their children taken from them, perhaps the plantations that they had been forced to work on could be split up and to provide land, right? And there were some efforts at this, right? We all heard of 40 acres and a mule. And so that approach to addressing the problem of, you know, rampant poverty after the Civil War was something that some radicals considered. You'd seen a little bit of it basically as a war measure during the war itself, and some very radical Republicans talked about this. The party as a whole was not that radical. The party as a whole was committed to the idea of free labor, right? Which, and that includes a commitment, an anti-slavery commitment. But it also, it didn't imagine a role for government in the redistribution of property that we can imagine today. So in a sense, that may have been the real loss, because what Reconstruction governments were then forced to do is apply taxes to raise money to do things to create, you know, some semblance of equality, economic equality from which freedmen could work. And that, first of all, alienated poor whites. And secondly, just you couldn't target relief in the way that you could have if benefits had been directly taken from plantation holders in terms of splitting up their lands and then distributing those to black families.
Now, the Southern, the former planter class, was very alarmed by all these developments and organized what they called a Redeemer movement. What was that all like?
Yeah, the Redeemer movement, it's a term that was applied to the white supremacist movement that overthrew Reconstruction. That is to say, these states were going to be redeemed from the Redeemers claimed was, you know, these corrupt Reconstruction governments. Of course, Northern governments were extraordinarily corrupt during the Gilded Age, and no one talked about redeeming them. But the Redeemers were, by and large, basically the Confederate elite under a new name. And they organized themselves. At first, they attempted to organize themselves and poor whites on a straightforward sort of racist rhetoric in elections, right? That you can't, you know, the Republican Party is a party of black people, we are white, and therefore you should vote with the Democrats. And it was less effective than they had expected. What you saw in the first elections under Reconstruction is that some poor whites, enough poor whites really, were willing to vote Republican. That is to say, were willing to vote with the freedmen against what, you know, were widely termed the rebels, right? The rebel elite who had dragged us into this war. And that alliance of poor whites and the free black population was the domestic, at least within the southern states, basis for political power. But the Redeemers come to power on a campaign of racism, but also this rhetoric of taxpayers, and they use that to disguise the fact that they're basically overturning election results through violence.
Yeah, and they use this rhetoric of profligacy, you know, that sort of a foretaste of Reagan's welfare queen rhetoric.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you look at, I've spent a fair amount of time with the South Carolina Taxpayers Convention, which met in 1871 and 1874. This was the, as I say, Confederate elite meeting with under a new label. And the language would not feel unfamiliar to anyone familiar with the sort of Goldwater to Reagan era discussions. Ballooning budgets and, you know, these terrible waste. And do you know how much we're paying government workers now? Of course, the reason people were paying government workers is first because they were building actual government infrastructure. Two, you had to pay government workers because they weren't all rich anymore. But it's all treated as fraud and waste. People are constantly picking out little sort of examples that are of how the government has been profligate. And, you know, it is the rhetoric that we hear so often today. In fact, the rhetoric I think we're starting to hear once again as we approach inauguration.
I'm speaking with Vanessa Williams, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. And then how did the North look on this?
You know, that in some ways I think is the real heartbreak of Reconstruction. Reconstruction fails in a meaningful sense because Northern Republicans stopped committing to it, right? They removed federal troops from the South in 1876. And one of the reasons, and I think a really important reason, that the Confederate elite were able to literally murder office holders, murder and intimidate black voters across the South and get away with it. One of the reasons they were able to do that is because they talked about themselves as taxpayers. And that rhetoric resonated in the North. And it resonated in the North particularly among wealthy Northerners, many of whom had become wealthy in part because of the war, who were looking at their cities and were seeing an influx of immigrants from Europe who were talking about things like unions, talking about things like class struggle. And suddenly, this idea of universal suffrage was not nearly as appealing as it had been. I talk a little bit about a particular instance of that, which is in New York City, where there was a serious effort by the business elite of the city to put the major powers of municipal government, let's say taxing and spending, in the hands of what they called a board of finance, which would be elected only by those who paid at least $500 in taxes a year. And this would have disenfranchised approximately half of the voting population of New York City. And it nearly succeeded. Luckily, the sort of working men organized themselves. They would have had to vote against their own suffrage. And because in the North, they were not campaigns of violence, they were able to defend their suffrage rights. But it really says something that after decades of having universal suffrage in New York, suddenly elites were absolutely actively working to overturn that. So when they don't have a commitment to universal suffrage at home, why would you expect them to have it in the South?
Yeah, I believe the Nation magazine was an editorial voice in favor of restricting the franchise.
Oh, yes, this was a striking. The South Carolina Taxpayers' Convention that I mentioned earlier was really a media darling for a brief period of time. And it was a media darling, you know, not just with the conservative elements in the North, but in traditionally radical, liberal New York papers. And that includes the Nation that we still know today, which was founded by abolitionists. But suddenly they are writing stories about how if the South can be redeemed, it will be by men like those in the South Carolina Taxpayers' Convention. And that bizarre willingness to put power back into the hands of the Confederate elite, who had been defeated only a few years earlier, put power back in the hands, I mean, literally of men who had refused to surrender at Appomattox, right? I mean, no one was confused about who these men were. But in the same period, you find the Nation, this bastion of liberalism, arguing that universal suffrage had run its course, that it was an anachronism in a city like New York with the sort of immigrant hordes descending upon us.
You mentioned the violent suppression of black voting and governance in the 1870s, but the scale of it and the brutality of it is really quite breathtaking. Like you described the Vicksburg Massacre in 1874. What was that about?
Yeah, the Vicksburg Massacre, and it was not by any stretch of the imagination unique, was one of many examples of taxpayer resistance, white taxpayer resistance that became violence. So in Vicksburg, it was tax day, and the sheriff in Vicksburg was black. And a militia, basically, frankly, a mob of white men, came to the courthouse and said, not only are we not going to pay our taxes, but we demand that all black office holders resign. And the sheriff thought he was going to die because they were armed. And what ends up happening is that the black militia locally, which was associated with the actual government, was trying to convene to ensure that the office holders were not thrown out at the point of a gun. But what happened was that they were killed. And so what you see is hundreds of black militiamen shot down. The governor, his wife, who wrote about this, described the white mob as not only shooting people, but murdering people where they fell if they had been wounded. And there are so many cases of this across the South. You know, just an example of the willingness of white Southerners to regain power at the point of a gun. And what's interesting, there's some work by an extraordinarily talented economist, Trevon Logan, who has looked at this sort of systematically, right? Because there are all these sort of cases of this taxpayer resistance that becomes violence, right? You see, for instance, in the upcountry, you see the Ku Klux Klan finding inroads in these communities that were generally poorer whites by helping local people resist taxes on alcohol. Now, you see all these instances, but if you look at it systematically, what you find is that places where taxes had gone up more, that is where Reconstruction governments had managed to raise just slightly more funds for schools and things of that sort, the violence against black legislators was higher. So there was a 3 percentage point increase in the likelihood of violence against a black legislator if taxes were $1 higher per capita. What that suggests, at least to me, is that one of the main points of conflict fundamentally was not just that black people were voting or that they were holding office, but that they were using the powers of government to create an actually democratic society, right? And to put in place the public goods that we all today expect as a basis for any democratic society. And that was beyond the pale for the former Confederates.
Now, fast forward to our century, and we remember the Mitt Romney remark about almost half the population just freeloading on the productive half. And Romney now is seen as a moderate and a voice of civility with the Republican Party, but he is speaking the language that these Confederates devised in the 1870s.
That's exactly right. So when Mitt Romney basically misstated a fact about the federal income tax, that is to say that at the time, approximately half of households have no net federal income tax liability. Doesn't mean they don't pay taxes. They pay all the other kinds of taxes, from payroll to sales to gas taxes and all the other taxes we pay every day. But because they didn't pay a net federal income tax, these Americans saw themselves as victims, thought that the government owed them things, and that these people were basically undeserving of political power or public benefits of any sort. And that rhetoric is absolutely the rhetoric of the Redeemers. There's a clear line that you can draw, because, I mean, what taxpaying is at the end of the day is the portion of our labor that pays for public goods. And it's the lifeblood of a democracy. So one reason you find conservatives opposing taxation so strongly is because they are opposing the capacity of the public, that is to say a democratic public that includes all people, the capacity of the public to provide the basic goods that would allow economic opportunity for all. And so, you know, an interesting fact is in the mid-20th century, taxes were actually not particularly controversial. Very few people realize that now, but it wasn't a major part of either the Democratic or Republican platform. But what happened was a civil rights movement. And then suddenly we get this rhetoric of the taxpayer, this reactionary rhetoric of the taxpayer, that is absolutely an echo of precisely the same dynamic that happened 100 years earlier, when suddenly there was an expansion of suffrage. Suddenly the American citizenry was actually going to be counted in total. And for conservatives, that was unacceptable.
A lot of this anti-tax rhetoric really crudely boils down to they're taking money from white people and giving it to black people. And it's not much more complicated than that.
That's absolutely right. The assumption that the taxpayer is white is ingrained in the same way that the assumption that a welfare recipient is black. They're flip sides of the same coin.
And there's no amount of fact-checking you can do to straighten people out on this.
No, I mean, it's precisely the same. I mean, if you think about, you know, who's a beneficiary of government? Well, to some degree, all of us, because we use public roads and attend public schools or benefit from people who do. You know, we're all government beneficiaries and we're all taxpayers. There's no way to exist in a market economy without paying taxes. But we found this rhetoric to be a very useful colorblind veneer to attach to what is basically a racist fear.
When people criticize Donald Trump for cheating on his taxes, there's a sizable portion of the population that doesn't condemn that, but actually envies and applauds it.
An interesting fact about American taxpayer attitudes is that there is near consensus that taxpaying is a civic responsibility. I mean, I'm talking about 90-95% agreement, which getting 95% of Americans to agree on something is genuinely a miracle. I looked at one point for survey results that had similar levels of consensus, and you have to ask people whether the moon landing happened or if Elvis is still alive. So there's this absolute commitment to the idea that taxpaying is patriotic. Where people differ is in their estimations of who pays taxes. For some people, being a taxpayer is basically a political badge of honor, and it is a badge that cannot be available to the people with whom you disagree. And increasingly, I think at the moment, it is a badge of whiteness. And so therefore, no amount of facts, as you said, are going to convince people that black people pay taxes, because that would violate the sort of underlying symbolism to which I'm committed. That doesn't mean that people think cheating on your taxes is acceptable. They really don't. You know, but Donald Trump managed to violate an extraordinary number of norms that almost everyone is committed to and suffer very few political consequences.
And finally, it does seem that the Democrats generally, this is certainly not the time to talk about raising taxes, but someday, I guess, again, it will be. The Democrats still seem paralyzed at the idea of or proposing a tax increase. And that Reagan revolution lives on in that inability to speak of raising taxes on people.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary fear, and it's not backed up by the data. I mean, there's no reason to raise taxes right now. The economy is in crisis. Millions and millions of people are out of a job. And there is no negative effect to running up a deficit right now. We desperately need to get the economy going. So it's basically a moot point in the foreseeable future. But there's no reason not to raise taxes for things that people value. You know, the most popular taxes that the federal government raises are for Social Security and Medicare. Almost everyone pays those taxes. They're really quite heavy. They're far heavier than the income tax for most Americans. But they're very popular taxes because they come with a benefit that everyone recognizes. You know, and also those taxes help defend those programs, right? Because you know you paid in, so if they're going to cut benefits, you're paying attention. And that's a really valuable political phenomenon. There's no reason to treat the American people as though they are children. If you believe that, and you don't really believe in democracy. And one of the things that adults do is pay their bills. And I think that Americans are absolutely willing to contribute when it is needed for public goods that they see as valuable. And if you look at the data, not only are people willing to pay taxes for things they think are valuable, they're willing to pay higher taxes for things they think are valuable, like education and healthcare. They're also thrilled to raise taxes on the rich. Oh, it's an extraordinarily popular idea. Not only with basically every Democrat, I mean, we're talking again, you know, 70, 80, 90% approval of the idea of raising taxes on rich people among Democrats. But you actually also find that poor Republicans like the idea of raising taxes on the rich, along with other ideas like raising the minimum wage. So the extent to which the Democratic Party has walked away from an extraordinarily popular economic agenda is, well, I suppose you'd say disappointing.
That was Vanessa Williamson, a fellow at Brookings and author of an article on the political roots of the concept of taxpayer in the current issue of Dissent magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some more by the flutist I played last week, Claire Chase. This is from Sonatine by Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.